All the Americans who would later make this passage to Peshawar experienced the same giddy sensation of entering a time warp that Wilson and Christie felt that afternoon. There is a sound in the streets of this city that must be experienced to be understood. It's like being inside a beehive, a whirl of turbans, beards, ox-drawn wagons, brightly painted buses, motor scooters turned into rickshaws and driven by Pashtun tribesmen. Every face looks biblical, and everything is in motion on the streets. Money changers, rug merchants, horse-drawn carts, men washing their feet and hands at the entrances of mosques, young boys scurrying about with trays of freshly baked Afghan bread and tea. It was all Kipling-esque, recalls Wilson, about this first of 14 trips to Peshawar. It felt like I was about to see Kim sitting on the cannon. It was a very, very turn-of-the-century British garrison atmosphere. You would see all those elaborate gates to military bases with cannons in front of them and all those guys snapping heels and coming to attention. Peshawar was only 30 miles from the Afghan border and minutes from the sprawling refugee camps. There were hidden storehouses and Afghan commanders living behind walled compounds surrounded by armed bodyguards. This was home to the leaders of the 7 Mujahideen military parties that the CIA and Zia's ISI had created to organize the war effort. But no one offered to take Wilson to visit these secret warriors. He hadn't yet earned the right to pass freely into that world. His schedule called for the traditional tour of the UN-supported refugee camps, a scene that appalled everyone who came to Peshawar. Millions of proud Afghans living in mud huts without running water or the ability to feed themselves. That month, 20,000 more had poured in, young boys and girls dressed in bright tribal clothing, the women with their faces covered. They came from the mountains and valleys of a country where their ancestors had lived for centuries, a legendary warrior nation not easy to intimidate and uproot. All brought horror stories with them of what had caused them to flee their country. In particular, they talked of helicopter gunships that hovered over their villages, hounding them even as they fled. It began to dawn on Wilson that there were only Afghans in this part of Pakistan, and that he was witnessing an entire nation in flight from the communists. This spectacle of mass suffering roused him, but he had been to refugee camps before, and for him there was something almost impersonal about such a mass of humanity. What did catch his attention that day was the absence of men. No teenagers, not even 40 or 50 year olds. He was told they were all fighting in the jihad. It was at his next stop, the Red Cross Hospital on the edge of Peshawar, that he lost his heart to the Afghans. Wilson's whole sense of himself rested on his self-image as a champion of the underdog. The victims of Sabra and Shatila had shaken him, but he was not proud that he had chosen to remain silent in the face of such brutality. Perhaps this had something to do with his reaction in the hospital when he met his first Afghan warriors. Scores of young men were laid out on hospital cots. The doctors sat with Wilson at the bed of a young boy and explained that his hand had been blown off by a Russian butterfly mine designed to look like a toy. This threw Wilson into a rage. A young Afghan who had stepped on a landmine explained he was proud of his sacrifice. "He told me his only regret was that he couldn't have his feet grown back so he could go kill Russians." Wilson moved from bed to bed, undone by the carnage, but increasingly aware why most of them were there. He spoke to a wounded commander as the effects of an anesthetic started to kick in. The man was waving his hand in a circle, speaking in Pashtun, describing the horror of the Russian gunship that had put him there. Not one of them complained about their lost limbs, but every one of them described their fury at the Russian gunships. And to a man, they asked for only one thing— a weapon to bring down this tool of Satan. Wilson wanted desperately to give something to these warriors, and before leaving, he donated a pint of his own blood. His next stop was a meeting with a council of Afghan elders, hundreds of whom were waiting for him in a huge, colorful tent decorated with cotton fabrics that looked like floating oriental rugs. As he walked in, Wilson was dazed by the sight of long white beards and turbans and the men's fierce, unblinking eyes. The Pakistanis had told them that the congressman had come as a friend offering assistance, and as he entered they shouted, "Allahu Akbar! God is great!" To Wilson it was like a scene out of the Old Testament. When the elders invited the Texan to speak, he delivered what he thought would be just the right message. I told them that they were the most courageous people in the world, and I said, "We're going to help you. None of your families will suffer from lack of shelter and food." I pledged that their soldiers would not be left to die in agony and that we would give them millions in humanitarian assistance. An old man rose to respond. He told Wilson he could keep his bandages and rice. What they needed was a weapon to destroy the gunships. These old men were no different from the young warriors in the hospital. They were all fixated on the Russian Mi-24 Hind helicopter. If he wanted to help, he should get them a gun to knock this devil out of the sky. It was at this moment that Charlie Wilson realized he was in the presence of a people who didn't care about sympathy. They didn't want medicine or charity. They wanted revenge. It's not uncommon for a single childhood experience, particularly if it is a traumatic one, to end up shaping an entire life. Sometimes it offers the only key to understanding what leads a person to make choices that would otherwise seem irrational. That certainly is the case with Charlie Wilson and his decision to embrace the lost cause of the Afghans. As is true with many boys, Charlie's dog was his best friend, his constant companion. Everyone in Trinity knew that Teddy was Charlie's dog. Whenever the two would burst into Cochrane's Corner drugstore, they would get equal billing. "Hello, Charlie. Hello, Teddy." And that's where Teddy died. A hideous, agonizing end on the floor of Cochrane's store, with Charlie and a crowd of neighbors and friends watching in horror. Charlie's mother, Wilmeth, held the boy back, fearing the dog might have rabies. For 10 minutes he watched, completely helpless. He was 13. Later, when the pharmacist discovered that Teddy had been fed finely ground glass, Charlie knew immediately who had done it. It was the work of his twisted neighbor, Charles Hazard, an old man who was forever threatening to do in any stray dog who soiled his well-manicured garden. It was the spring of 1946, and that night Charlie poured gasoline over Hazard's precious plants and set his lawn on fire. But in the cold light of dawn, he realized that this wasn't sufficient revenge. That's when he had one of those brilliant flashes that never failed in later years to spring fully grown into his mind whenever he found himself in similar situations, facing bullies who needed to be reined in. Hazard was a city official, and Charlie suddenly realized that an election was about to be held. On this occasion, he found himself recalling his mother's fury at the way the liquor interests had managed to bribe Trinity's black citizens with beer and cash to accept a ride to the polls to vote down the referendum to outlaw alcohol. Looking out over Charles Hazard's blackened lawn, Charlie concluded that if he could only get a car, he could mobilize his own secret army of voters to defeat Hazard. In those days, farm boys could get special driving permits at 13. He got his permit, and then persuaded his parents to let him use the family's new car, the first they'd ever had, a 2-door Chevrolet. When the polls opened, Charlie was waiting with his first carload of voters. He said only one thing before letting them out. "I don't want to influence your vote, but I'd like you to know that Charles Hazard poisoned my dog."